Welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. This is where we explore the intersection of society, culture, data and technology. This podcast offers insights into the evolving role of data and AI in shaping our world. I'm your host, Kate Carruthers, and this time I'm talking with Dr. Tama Lever. Tama is Professor of Internet Studies at Curtin University in Perth, WA, and he is the immediate past president of the Association of Internet Researchers and a regular commentator and a chief investigator in the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child. So his research interests include children's data, privacy and rights in an online world, and artificial intelligence, among many other things. So welcome, Tama.
Great to be here.
So what are we going to have a chat about? There's so many things in your world of research interests that we could delve into.
Yeah, no, look, the world is very much feeding me in terms of keeping my research alive. Yeah, we can start from anywhere. I mean, I can say something really provocative like for the children's experience of generative AI is kind of like amplifying racism. We can go backwards from there if you like.
Yeah, well, you know, every child I talk to is using generative AI and their parents don't realize this.
Yeah, so that's terrifying to me. There was a survey out from Common Sense Media, which sort of does a snapshot of children's media use, and it was looking at last year, and it said that one third of US kids under the age of, I think it's either 8 or 10, were using generative AI tools ostensibly for learning. And given the paucity of literacy, I guess, out there about how these things actually operate and how reliable they are or aren't, that for me is just a really terrifying number. And we have, to the best of my knowledge, no comparable stats for Australia yet. But even if it's a fraction of that, the idea that kids are using AI for learning, probably outside of formal learning environments, probably in ways that their parents might not be able to decode for them, or indeed without their parents' knowledge. It's just a really weird world, considering so many of the results we get back are not anchored in reality in any meaningful way. And that I think people just really, truly don't get the idea that these tools lie or make mistakes or whatever word you
think. Lying makes them seem like they have agency, like they're just big guessing engines. So they choose a plausible answer and people don't realize this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best analogy I've heard is that they're mansplaining engines, that they very confidently get it wrong quite a lot, but it takes a lot to go, oh, are you sure you're right there? And that's terrifying, because that level of confidence, I mean, we just look at global politics, confidence in arbitrarily saying you're right, regardless of whether you are or not, seems to be the winning strategy for lots of things. And if we have technology is doing that as much as our politicians, then it must be really hard to navigate that sort of information landscape, especially when you're quite young and haven't got the contextualizing tools sorted out yet.
Well, I read a research paper the other day that says most generative tools are skewing right wing.
Yeah, so, I mean, it depends what they're hoovering up. I mean, lots of deals are being made about, I think a lot of the big companies realize they need slightly more authoritative sources than just the internet as a whole.
The internet that includes Kiwi Farms and 4chan, you mean?
Yeah, all of the above. Yeah. But I think they're signing deals with particular news companies. But obviously, I think it's safe to say that the news to different companies skew in particular directions. And if you're signing deals with, say, Fox News and News Corp predominantly, then you know even the real-time information you're getting is going to skew in a particular way. So that's in and of, you know, that's concerning in and of itself. And we're also living in a political climate where calling that right wing or calling it skewing away is something that people generally can't say anymore, at least not in the US context.
No, you can't say.
Hopefully,
can say a lot of things in the US context now.
Yeah, no, that's completely right. But I think trying to even have the conversation about whether this is skewing in a particular direction or not must be very hard in that context. We at least have the capacity to be able to say that. But it's very difficult. The only way we can see this is to wait for outputs and then map them and go, okay, what are we getting? Oh, this does skew in a particular way. And some of the research we did, we deliberately chose the visual tools, so the things that make images and video, because you can see the bias, you can see the skewing much more than you can say in text, or it's more obvious. So we, for example, have run a whole series of prompts around children, innocent children, things like that. But then we also tried to see how Australia is positioned. And if you just ran, say, two prompts, one is visualize an Australian's house, visualize an Aboriginal Australian's house, put them next to each other. They are so different, so different. And in any other context, we would say these tools are racist. Now, they're not. But what we can say is that these tools have been trained on data sets that lead to outputs that would look racist to most everyday users.
But this is the same problem that we've had with Google for many years, where you Google a picture of a doctor and it's mostly men.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
It's just the data, because there are more pictures of men in there, and the AI has been trained on the internet, which is already, we know, is biased. So
yeah, absolutely. And I guess in the old US context, like the pre-Trump 2.0, I think we could have said that at least Google knows enough to be embarrassed by those things and tries to actively fix them. At least it's you know, it makes some effort on that front. We know that effort's probably not just not happening now, but it's probably being actively discouraged, which is even more worrying than before. Bias is a really tricky thing. It's baked into most of our tools in some way or another.
That's why I've moved away from Google as a search engine. So I did a bit of an experiment with DuckDuckGo, which is Bing under the covers, which is not satisfactory, let me tell you. So I've recently moved to Quant.
Okay.
It's Quant, if people want to try it.
And would you recommend it? Like, does it?
I'm liking it. I'm liking it. It's better than DuckDuckGo. And I've moved to Vivaldi for my browser. So
you sound like a proper rebel still. That's the trick here is how do you mainstream that? Like, I think that's the real challenge. Like, even DuckDuckGo for a bunch of people is a step further than they're willing to take. So fixing the mainstream tools, unfortunately, is still really important, because that's still as far as I think most people are traveling.
So one of the challenges I think we've got with the use of, with children and the use of AI is schools and universities are actively encouraging them to use them. So I don't know about your place, but my place, we are getting them to use these tools and, you know, trying to give them constructive ways to engage with them. But that is something the educators are doing. And in the primary and sort of high school context, I don't think the parents are aware of what they might need to watch out for. What are some of the things parents should watch out for?
Yeah, look, I think you're absolutely right. Like, there are different pressures and different pushes. And I think universities are terrified of being like left behind and looking like they're coming out of the Stone Age all of a sudden. But at the same time, the rush in tertiary is speed over contextualizing perhaps. But I think if we look back to say that the primary learning years, I think that's exactly where the challenges are. Like, I think there's some really basic literacy stuff about how these tools work, that if you start from that premise, whatever you're doing would be okay. So if you start from the premise that A, these tools are not intelligent, B, that they're basically just doing stats, so they're recombining things in a way that they have to have seen before, and C, they don't know what they're saying. If you start from that premise, then it's always going to be an interesting experiment. You're always experimenting when you're asking for something. But I think, there will be a real effort put in over the next couple of years to try and help any parent be at least literate enough to know that, so that they can help their you know, kids if they're either experimenting with these tools for themselves or if they're encountering them in formal education. But there's that delay, the delay between rolling out a tool, often it turning up in all sorts of contexts, and then the literacy coming in. That delay is really tricky, because when you're talking about kids, the impressions that they're getting, especially quite young kids, are going to be really skewed by what they experience over those first interactions. And often it's framed by popular culture that doesn't give you that level of suspicion. I was trying to think, what's the most recent big sort of AI film that, say, a seven-year-old might have seen? And it's probably The Giant Robot, which was a great film. It was a lovely film. But it's very much about the AI hero. As soon as it's not in a corporate world and it's forced to think for itself, it tries to save the world and save all the creatures and everything else. It's a lovely film. But if that's your idea of what AI is, it doesn't give you that immediate pause or suspicion that you probably should have when it's giving you outputs, depending on what you're, you know, almost any tool that you're using at the moment.
So many interesting questions are running through my head at the moment. One thing I really want to think about is what does this, how do we manage this in the world where privacy is driven by explicit consent? Because I reckon the privacy model of consent is kind of broken. So the AI companies have stolen all of our data without consent. There's all of this stuff. So there's this whole world of privacy that is changing now, and I don't think the regulation can kind of keep up.
No, and I think it's incredibly difficult just because we don't have established, or it doesn't feel like we have established privacy frameworks that make sense around not just AI as tools, but the various places that it turns up. So I think one of the thing that makes this an urgent challenge is not the tools that exist, but the fact that so much money has been invested in those tools that the companies that are investing in them are sticking it into literally any program they've got because they have to justify the enormous investment and cost. So why on earth does Microsoft Office suddenly have a co-pilot trying to help me in Excel? I know what I'm doing. Why is, I think the most extreme example.
I tried to opt out. It was so many dark patterns. Yeah. So many dark patterns. It took me like an hour to work it out.
But even like laptops are coming now with a co-pilot button. So the idea of trying to escape thinking in that frame is really, really tricky. But even MS Paint's got a generative AI working in the background now. And that was always the thing. If you wanted to give your six-year-old a tool to try and learn to use a mouse and draw a butterfly, oh, use MS Paint. It's so small and so thin, nothing can go wrong. Now it's like there's still an AI in there. So I completely agree that the privacy model, when you think about that stuff being hoovered up backwards, is really, really tricky, and not least of all because it's very, very clear these models have to learn from how people are interacting with them. We know we're a generation of guinea pigs where how we use these tools will inform the next generation of use. And to some extent, it's important that that's happening because these are really quite bad tools in the way that they work now. So if they don't learn to get better, they'll never be of real use to anyone. But the question of explicit consent is so hard to do in that framework because these are moments of interaction that simply don't give you the capacity to make that choice. So either it's terms and conditions you've agreed to years ago, or I saw Instagram the other day had a little disclaimer like, if you want to use the Meta AI bot in your chat, it basically voids all of the privacy things you've already said. It sucks up all your stuff because the only way we can feed it your stuff is to give it your stuff and ignore your privacy. Oh, by the way, it'll keep it, but you know, you might get a picture out of it. Or you know, so that those sort of logics of even the things that might have some boundaries are being undone if you explicitly use this tool. But nobody's going, oh, I want to make a funny picture of a unicorn dancing. Oh, I've given up my privacy like that.
Nobody joins that up. And that's the thing I keep saying is convenience trumps privacy and security every single time. Yep. So, you know, I've done it before with, you know, some of those mashup things on Instagram, but I literally deleted my Facebook and Instagram accounts recently. And I've talked to some people saying, why don't you do it too? And they say, I can't because I need Facebook Marketplace. So that is the killer app that keeps people rusted on, and they're willing to give away all their data just to have the utility of Facebook Marketplace.
Well, I think at the end of the day, there was a reason that we found all of these tools useful. Like social affordances, social connectivity is still really valuable. And for a lot of people, asking your social network to exist on a different platform or a privacy-friendly space or going back to email or whatever is too much work for a lot of people. And that's not them not caring. It's saying that they are so... I think most people believe that they will never be able to control their data and privacy anyway. So why make their life difficult when actually sharing this with the immediate friends and family is actually really good for them? It's a positive experience. And, you know, they might have some privacy settings where privacy is a negotiation with other users of that platform, but not privacy from that platform. And I think that textual shift is one that people often haven't necessarily spent a lot of time thinking about, but it is the bargain that they've made implicitly. But I do think, you know, there is still real value in social connectivity through these platforms. And we don't really have a big, wide-scale platform that gives you that same affordance without the wholesale theft of data in the name of advertising.
Yeah. The advertising model is so broken, isn't it?
Mm.
Now, so one of the areas that you are also interested in is visual social media, isn't it? So you mentioned, you touched on that with AI. So what's happening in that part of the world? Because I've done some tests with DALL-E, and you know, say things to it like take all the words out of the picture and it puts more words in. So it's.
I think if you really want to see how stupid these tools are, it is exactly that. It's images with words in. Like even the most cutting edge model, if you ask it to put in a 3-line poster in the background of something and it generates 4 images, 3 of those will either have misspellings or just weird letter formations that aren't quite letters. And I think that's where we can see the immense amount of work that these tools are doing is still really, really infantile. Like it's really at the early stages. And one of the images I love that I use in all my talks when I want to do a really quick explanation of how stupid these things are is I punched into, I think with DALL-E 3, generate me an image of a really sleek calculator. And so it gave me this wonderful sort of chrome calculator with sort of blue glowing backgrounds and everything. And it has 5 number 2s on it because it has no idea of what a calculator is. It's simply seen lots of calculator-like pictures and it knows sort of is this sort of shape and it's got lots of buttons, but it doesn't know anything. And I think that for most people is enough to go, oh, I understand how stupid it really must be then because it can't figure out context or use. It's simply seen lots of calculators. And so I think, yeah, that if we start from that premise, that's how all visual social media works. And the terrifying thing is seeing like Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, going, oh, we're enabling a whole generation of creators with these tools that are built on generative AI. And you think, God, a world where all visual content creation is basically based on remixing the crap that was already there before is so sad and disheartening. That is, you know, I really hope that's not the future that we end up with. But
I think some people will reject it. Like I immediately subtitled my blog, which has been running since 2002, Handcrafted. It's handcrafted. There might be the odd thing that I'll flag as an AI-generated thing, but literally I write every word myself.
Yeah, but I think that's almost a niche thing now.
Yeah.
And it is weird. Like it turns up in places you don't imagine. I know in just working in the university, I think, oh, well, we're all very risk, you know, we're very risk averse on AI. None of us want, you know, anyone to think we've ever used AI for anything because it's seen as you know, not real authorship and things like that. But then you talk to people like, oh, no, I'm just crunching all my notes and getting like a first structure out. And it's like, that is a legitimate use, but it's also part of the struggle with finding your own structure is part of the process, or at least it is for me. And maybe other people have really different processes. And maybe that's one of the things that will shift over time is that there will be new ways of writing that are sort of informed and can use these tools. But for me, the challenge there is that all of the emphasis is simply on the speed of productivity, not the quality of what you get. So if that led to a world where I could write the things I really want and this would help me with structure, but it was allowed me to have those flourishes that I think are sort of the things that I do well, great. But I actually think it's just pushing people to write chunks of stuff. And the terrifying world I think we're going to live in is with email. We're going to have, okay, here's my outline. I feed it into an AI. It writes the long version. Yeah. I send it to someone. They feed it to their AI. They turn all the long version back into a short version. And it's just us sending crappy bullet points to each other with the AIs basically doing unnecessary work at both ends.
Well, the thing is that makes me question the very nature of the communication. Like, you know how we joke that meeting could have been an email?
Yep.
Should that email have been a text message? You know, so like, are we doing unnecessary things? And we need to start asking ourselves a question because we do run the risk of these AI bots just talking to each other and none of us actually consuming the communication. So what's the point of that communication?
Yeah, no, I think that's up to a really good question. And it does beg the question, if we're so married to certain ideas of communication and productivity that we're just fooling ourselves and it's basically making busy work for AIs to do so that they can burn $1 trillion.
At what cost to the environment, though? You know, there's real questions about that. And that's why they're selling all of those co-pilot computers now, because they want to bring the processing back down onto the device because they don't want to be paying for it in the cloud. So that's what's behind that. And, you know, companies, big companies like Dell and stuff love to sell more hardware. So It's good for it's a win-win. But that's really about bringing the compute load down onto the local machine.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the one of the big furphies at the moment is even with AI's, with ChatGPT's more expensive models and more expensive packages, we are not paying anywhere near the amount that it is actually costing for each process to happen. Yeah. And I think that's going to be a really big problem where we actually start having to pay the full actual cost of AI. It's going to be astronomical because there is just no way that these things are not burning through really high cost stakes stuff for terribly small outputs.
And, well, the thing that DeepSeek did that kind of upended the apple cart was proving that they had done some clever stuff behind the scenes and did it for like $6 million, I think. And then there's the fact that OpenAI took, I think, $9 billion of investment that they had spent before it landed. And they are spending something like $2.50 to $3 to get every dollar of revenue that they get.
Yeah,
that's not a sustainable business model. So sometime the party's got to end. Someone will have no
sense. It's sustainable for the time being, and that's the terrifying thing. They are burning so much actual capital that they really can sustain that for a couple of years. Because
as long as people are willing to keep giving the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. People keep giving these people more money. Like if you look at how many times Sam Altman's gone, oh, I'd like another $1 billion. Who should I chat with? It keeps happening. And that's the terrifying thing. We're betting on AI being the future every time that conversation happens. And at some point, we're going to have to bet differently, but we're not there yet.
Well, I think in the US, there's an underlying idea amongst the tech bros that they can replace all the smart people, all the intellectuals and people with degrees with AI and just have a bunch of drone workers. That's how I think they're thinking of the future. So they don't think they need college-educated people for the future. They can get rid of all of them and just have AIs ruling over an underclass of workers. And they don't really need too many of them either. So I think that's the kind of dystopian future they're thinking about. Perhaps the rest of us need to start to imagine what we want to do as an alternative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think there is a future where AI can be carefully and contextually used for, like, I'm not of the, we should never use these tools, because I do think in the right circumstances, used the right way, they can be pretty amazing. But I think the whole idea that we're going to throw every search that we're ever going to do at an LLM is genuinely terrifying. Search, while not that effective, was still maybe a tenth of the environmental cost of doing any particular query. And we just created really expensive, less effective ways of doing things. And in any context, that should be insane. And yet, you know, the AI rhetoric is so powerful that we believe it's the future because we keep getting told by everyone who's asked that that's what the future looks like.
Well, I genuinely think AI is the future, but what kind of AI? And I was teaching a course yesterday at Australian Graduate School of Management on AI for organizational innovation. And I was saying to them, like, how we use AI and how we build our AI now determines the future of it. We have agency in this. We're not just the passive recipients of these big corporations. We have agency and we can shape the future of what we do with AI. We don't just have to use it the way they tell us to. So that was my challenge to the people in the course, is go away and think about how you can master AI, not AI master you.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's the thing, that if we can enable young people to believe that no matter what the tool is, they should be able to expect and ask it to do the things the way they need it to be done, not the way it wants to do it. And I say wants in a non-agentic way. That's the future that we have to equip young people for. We want really young people to get used to the idea that any tool that they use could and should be better, and that they should be able to have a voice on how it gets made better. And that includes, like, I think there was a children's summit just before the Paris AI summit a couple of weeks ago. And the Turing Institute, amongst others, ran a really great summit with young people. And the sort of things they were saying they want AI to be able to do, and the sort of guardrails and ethics that it should be able to be constrained by, are exactly the sort of thing that we should be looking at. I think young people's voices in this space are really powerful, but we have no habit or history of listening to young people on this front at all.
No, especially in Australia. God forbid. So what can parents do to sort of try and get their kids ready for this world? Because it's here, it's not going away anytime soon. I know where Zitron says AI is just a huge lie and it's all going to fall over. I don't think it's really going to fall over. It's here. And it's so pervasive now that I don't think it can be gotten rid of. So the genie's well and truly out of the bottle. So what can parents actually do?
So, unsurprisingly, the sort of advice we would give to parents are very similar to other sorts of advice about, you know, gaming and internet stuff. The most basic thing parents can do is sit with their kids and use some of these tools. Look at some of the sort of search summaries that come back and say, oh, is this a good result? If you're going to generate something, having an adult there who knows the context and go, oh, that's really interesting, but these three things are actually completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And being able to reflect that back, that this is what's happening, or generate a picture and go, oh, is that what you imagined? What's wrong about this? It got some of the way, but it did these things and it invented the other three fingers that most people don't have. Those sort of really basic critical practices where parents, and it is hard to create that time. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting parents are doing it wrong by not having done this. But if they have the time to sit down, use some of these tools with kids and help young people think through critically what these tools are not doing right or what they are very confidently doing wrong, I think that's really enabling. And I think we will reach a point soon where curriculum is doing that as well, but we're not there yet, or we're not there across the board yet. There are definitely pockets of really strong curriculum development about trying to do these sort of things and help young people think critically, but parents have to be part of the solution for the time being, at least. And ideally the solution for forever is, I think, parents gaming or parents using AI tools or parents exploring the internet with kids when they're younger is actually a really enabling thing for kids to have a critical reflex to whatever they're doing, building or creating online. And we need to encourage that with AI as much as anything else.
It just came into my mind. So in response to some of your earlier comments, so I've applied to do a PhD. And my supervisor said, just for your first draft of your literature review and your application, just get AI, generative AI to draft it. And I did, because I'd done my master's thesis on the topic, so I was very familiar with the literature. Yeah. So I did it, and full half of the citations were fake. They sounded so good. And I was like, oh God, I hope this one's real, because it was sounded really good. Search for it. No, it doesn't exist. Yeah. So that critical thing of, you need to have some context, you need to be able to look at it and go, that sounds really good, but I bet it's not right. That thing is the most important thing that you can have, is just that human sense, that human knowledge and discernment.
It will get worse, because as these tools get incrementally better, the 50% of made up stuff will end up being 10% of made up stuff. But still having the context to recognize the made-up stuff is what makes these tools, you know, the difference between this being really useful for someone and introducing huge catastrophic errors into their work. And so the people have to know what they're doing before they ask the questions. And that's really tricky, because people are not using these tools as we see them now in that way. People are using them as a replacement for search, or as a way of summarizing knowledge. And they just don't work in that way. And hopefully we'll get to the point, like, I still don't understand why most AI tools don't have a gateway function where they're like, this is a query that I can answer by pinging Wikipedia or Googling it traditionally first, rather than generating a response from the corpus of stuff I've absorbed. And that sort of switching would solve so many of those problems, because you don't need AI for a lot of this stuff. But because it's sort of the novelty or the cause celeb right now, we just keep punching stuff into AI that we really shouldn't.
Well, part of the challenge is that generative AI isn't very good at that. So you typically have to then integrate RAG models to do that, and that they don't want to spend their time doing that because they're trying to sell generative AI. So that's it's not in their interest to do that. So they probably won't be doing it.
Yeah. Well, I think they're trying to make generating, you know, I mean, the tools for generating RAG models are getting easier and easier to access. And I think they imagine the average user being someone that actually sort of sub-trains a little AI and teaches it all the things it needs to know. I think that's very, very optimistic that most people are ever going to even know enough to plonk the things in to try and, you know, sub-train their models.
It's hard enough explaining that to people who are building AI, that if you're using generative AI, you're going to need to integrate a RAG model. And they're like, what's a RAG model? And it's like, oh, well, let me explain that to you. And this is the data engineers who are building this stuff. So, you know, if the data engineers haven't heard of it and don't know it exists, you know, what chance does the ordinary punter have? So yeah, that's the right. real challenge.
And I think most people's imagining of what AI is and what it's good for is, you know, the version that OpenAI gives you with the voice interface. It's a little black talky bubble that you chat with, and that's their imagining of what AI is and how it should work. The idea that it's actually a whole lot of labor to feed it a whole bunch of PDFs and say, try and look at this stuff and weight it more heavily than other stuff you've read or absorbed because this is the stuff that matters. That's a whole lot of labor that 99% of people will never be able to do or have the time to do.
Well, it's the importance of prompt engineering, but normal people haven't even heard of that term and don't even know it's a thing. And, you know, there are various prompt engineering models that you can adopt, and most normal people haven't even heard of them. So they don't even know that such a thing exists.
But prompt engineering sort of goes back to where we were before. It's us accepting how bad these tools are and going, we have to adapt us to the tool, rather than going, we shouldn't need really complex prompt engineering. We should have tools that work or deliver on a confined set of things that does well and that we know it does well, rather than these generalist tools that do everything kind of bad.
And that sort of leads to where do we think the future's going? Like, my genuine belief is that we're not going to be using these big AI models all the time for everything in future. I suspect that we're going to have smaller, personalized, customized model on our phone and stuff that do jobs that we care about. So
I would be happy for that future to turn up. I mean, my experience of trying to use the AIs on the phone to do things is they're so much worse than the previous things we had. I mean, I have very limited needs as to what I want an AI to do on my phone. And when I say time to home to my phone, I want it to tell me using Google Maps how long it's going to take to drive through traffic. My old phone could do that. My new phone keeps trying to feed that to Gemini. It tells me all sorts of interesting things about my workplace, but it won't give me a bloody map. So I think we've actually gone 4 steps backward, and we're doing the heavy lifting to try and make these models better. We are all the beta testers. It's just that they've stopped putting the word beta at the end of everything like they used to. I mean, Gmail was in beta for what, years? Because they were kind of admitting that we were teaching it how to work. If we just stuck that word at the end of all of these models and admitted they don't work the way you imagine yet, you're doing the training, that would at least be something. But they're not even admitting that. They keep pretending that they're on the way to making, you know, what the Verge people call AI God. And that's just around the corner. Of course it's bloody not.
Oh, you know, I was talking to Tony Cohen from Turing Institute before Christmas, and about, you know, hallucinations going to go away. He said, oh, we might be very close. And then we had another chat, and I'm going to get him on the podcast, but he was like, yeah, no, we're not. Hallucinations are going to be with us for a while. So yeah. It was like he was briefly optimistic.
Yeah, but it's as you said at the beginning, it's getting away from those words. I mean, Sue Sidarov and I wrote a paper just trying to get away from hallucinations and what is the words that we should use. And I think we ended up with glitches because at least they're technical things. Like, we understand that a technology glitches. People don't, or people hallucinate, but not in the way that AI imagines. So just changing the terminology so we can authentically use these things as tools, not as thinking systems that are supposed to be based on people, will be a huge achievement at this point.
That is a very good statement. Thank you for that. And that's probably a really good spot to leave it. Thank you so much for your time, Tama.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Kate.